particularly for volunteers, they need to see the fruits of their labour. Employees, sure, they need to be able to understand the long-term vision and be able to get there. But when you have someone on board that's a volunteer, and volunteers can be good and bad. We've had our fair share of really annoying ones, but we've had our fair share of great ones. But I think the key is to keep them motivated. There has to be tangible results, and with any organisation, big or small. But when they see the fruits of their labour, when they can feel that they are reaching a goal, it's so exciting for them. Mm. You know what I mean? To see that pay off, and to see how much we raised, and to, you know, come to an event where everything is just looking amazing and there's people in the room and everyone's happy. I mean, that is just such an amazing feeling.
This is the Inno the Buzz podcast, helping smart businesses be even more innovative.
Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Welcome to episode number 103 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, designed to help smart businesses committed to innovation, to service and to modern marketing become even more innovative. In this episode, I'm privileged to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Stephanie Lorenzo, the founder of Project Futures, a not-for-profit organisation dedicated to ending human trafficking. Steph started Project Futures 8 years ago after she had read the memoir of international human rights activist Somali Mam and her story of being sold into sexual slavery and her work to help other young women after she escaped. Pretty amazing stuff. The Project Futures community is now raising over $1 million a year for anti-trafficking projects in the Asia-Pacific region. So they're doing some fabulous work. Steph tells us about the launch of Project Futures, its growth over the past 8 years, and how to know when it's time for the founder to exit a business. Without further ado then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Steph Lorenzo. Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to have as my guest on the InnovaBuzz podcast today, all the way from Sydney in Australia, Stephanie Lorenzo, who's the founder of Project Futures, which is a not-for-profit organisation dedicated to ending human trafficking. So welcome to the podcast, Steph. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here.
So you started Project Futures 8 years ago, and we'll get you to tell the story about that and how that came about in a moment. But I just wanted to give a shout out to Anthony Howard from the Confidair Group, who suggested that we get you on the podcast.
Yes, thank you, Anthony. He's great. We've known him for a while.
Yeah. So Project Futures, tell us how that came about. First of all, tell us what it does, what the purpose is, how it came about and where it's at now.
Absolutely. Well, Project Futures is, as you mentioned, an Australian not-for-profit organisation. Our mission is to empower individuals to take action against human trafficking and exploitation of men, women and children. We do that by, you know, hosting events, doing media conferences, trying to get stories out about our partner projects so that people in Australia can understand what is going on in this, you know, one of the world's third largest crime industry worldwide, which is human trafficking. And I guess our job is very unique in that we partner with service providers on the ground in the Asia Pacific region and in Australia who work with victims of human trafficking and sex trafficking, and we help to fund their work through our activities and initiatives, if you like. So it started, the whole process started about a decade ago when I picked up a book as a 21-year-old. And it was about a woman called Somali Mam, who was actually a woman who was sold into prostitution as a young girl in Cambodia. And I read her book from cover to cover in one night while I was in Cambodia. And I guess as someone that grew up in a very lucky country that is Australia, with great family and the privileges that I had, I just was shocked, I guess, that something so dire could happen to such young women and girls. And I just wanted to do something about it. And my background is in marketing and communications. And I thought, what can my skill set sort of do to help these people? And everyone knows that the not-for-profit world needs funding. It's something that not-for-profits always struggle with. And I thought with my background and with my skills, I could use those to my advantage and my networks in Australia and run some events to raise money for the work that Somali did over in Cambodia, which was run three safe houses that rescued, rehabilitated, reintegrated and educated women and children who were forced into the sex trade. And I guess that, just in a nutshell, is how it all began, the journey began.
And if I understand correctly, you didn't set out to start a fundraising charity that would be around 10 years later.
Not at all. Set
out with one event, a cycling event through Cambodia.
Yes, that's exactly right.
And that one thing led to another.
Yeah, so back then, as I mentioned, I was about 21 years old when I read the book, and I was lucky enough to participate in a charity cycle challenge for another organisation in Australia that a friend of mine invited me on. So in order to do that, we both had to raise $5,000 each, and we would get to go on this really amazing trip to Cambodia. Like 10 years ago, it was very cheap to go to Cambodia. Cambodia wasn't a place that many people really went to back then. It was still sort of getting known in the Western world, I guess, because of the issues that had happened not so long ago around Pol Pot regime and the genocide that happened there. So it was quite a cheap country to go to. And when I was there and I was participating on this amazing cycle challenge, the guy that actually ran the cycling tour was Australian. And so I got talking to him, and after I read Somali's book, I thought, well, if I can do one thing, and I've had so much fun on this trip, I'm just going to organise a similar bike ride, but it's going to be for a different cause. So I kind of used the same model, I guess, that this Australian charity used to try and get people on this bike ride. And I sort of set out, I gave myself a year. I branded the bike ride. It was called the Futures 09 Cycle Challenge. Then even the name Project Futures didn't exist, but I thought, let's think about the future. And so it was called Futures 09 Cycle Challenge. I organised it in 2008. It was going to happen in March 2009. And, you know, Adam, the guy that ran the cycling company, said, you just get the numbers and I'll make the itinerary. I'll give you a cost price and then you can sort of add fundraising on top of that. You get the people and I'll sort out all the logistics on the ground. So I went off and I did that. And at first, I was really nervous because we didn't have a charity set up. It was just come to Cambodia, do this. You know, we didn't give out tax receipts or anything. It was like, I'm raising money for this woman. You can do it however you want. Ask your friends. You know, put money aside yourself. You're going on it's kind of a holiday because you're seeing a great country, but you're also doing something for a great cause. And lo and behold, like, we had 21 people join. We had, I only knew about five of them. So the majority of people I didn't know, they just loved the idea of what I was doing and they had read Somali's story as well and they were compelled to help. And a year later, 21 people, we'd raised $80,000 US, which was incredible. And we were very lucky to be able to meet Somali, visit one of the centres that she supported. We actually spent International Women's Day in one of those centres, and from there it was like, how can you come back to Australia to your cushy life and just do nothing? So I thought, well, this is one good deed, but I feel like we can allow it to continue, because even to organise that bike ride wasn't hard for me to do. So, yeah, we came back in March 2009. In June 2009, we registered Project Futures as a company limited by guarantee, a non-profit entity in Australia, and we got a board together. And we started to organise events just to raise money. And we all did it on a voluntary level. No one got paid for pretty much the first 3-4 years of running it. And it was really incredible. We did some really amazing things as young people doing it in our extra time.
So you did this while you were working full-time to earn a living.
Yeah. Correct. That's right, yes.
Would have taken a lot of energy, I guess.
Yeah, but, you know, it was different, I think, as well, 10 years ago, the landscape and the charity landscape, particularly in Australia, to what it is now. There was less startups sort of back then, particularly charity startups. There was no organisations that were very well known dealing with anti-human trafficking. They were the really big organisations. There was not many organisations dealing with particularly youth and young people. Our mission was all about Gen Ys, and there was, you know, this Gen Y was all in our collateral. We were Gen Ys leading Gen Ys, just doing things that Gen Ys loved, but for a cause. So it was kind of a new concept. It's not so new anymore. There's a lot more startups now. There's a lot more young people that kind of grow up with this mentality of social justice and social cause at the forefront of their mind, ethical business, you know, all of that type thing. Their values align with what they want to do in their life. And I think the landscape is changing, and it is getting more difficult for NGOs in the best of ways, because there's a lot more springing up, so that it becomes more, I don't like to say the word competition, but you are fighting for funding. And that's very hard for many organisations. Yep. And many causes are similar. So how do you choose between one and the other, you know? Yes. So,
And I imagine getting attention is quite a bit of a challenge, because, like you say, there's lots of charities around, so people contribute to one that they might come across at a given point in time, and then we've already contributed. So
correct.
There's only so much we can give, yeah.
That's exactly right. Exactly right.
So on that first bike ride, I'm fascinated because you said, what, there were 5 out of 21 that you knew personally and the others.
Yes.
So how did you market it? How did you get the attention onto it and get people
and
signing up?
Yeah. We definitely, so Facebook was quite new back then. I think Facebook started in like 2006 or something. So it was still sort of new. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm 32 now. I didn't get a Facebook account till I was, I think, 20, 21 or something. Now people are getting Facebook accounts and Instagram accounts a lot earlier. But we use social media to drive a lot. I mean, I had a great network of friends who, you know, I asked to get on board. So the first 5 were, you know, basically 2 friends of mine. One of the friends brought her sister and her brother-in-law along, and my own sister. So the rest of it, once we got those few starters on board and we had a website and we promoted with people with profile pics and a little bio of themselves, and everyone was quite young and, you know, excited, and it was very, the brand itself and the communication, I think, just with my background looked good, and we made sure of that. We just promoted it on social media, and I think there are people that did it for different reasons. There were people who did it because they wanted to go to Cambodia and they thought, what a good group of people to go with. It's not super expensive and I'm doing it for a good cause. There were other people that were like, I really care about this cause, and what a great, interesting way to back a cause. There were people that read Somali's story like me and were just so inspired and overwhelmed, and we were the only organisation really doing anything for Somali mum in Australia. So if they were in Australia, then, you know, if they wanted to do something for her, they could kind of do
that
it.
Was it.
So yeah, it was a really interesting group of people, and I would get random calls on my phone because obviously my mobile would be out there and my email would be out there, and I just get inquiries and I talk to people, and I get people that sometimes talk to me say I can convince people pretty easily. So I think that was a pretty good thing. We even had someone come all the way from Canada, which was amazing, from America. So to do that was incredible.
Mm. Yeah, well, I think it's, I mean, you pointed out that, you know, there's different reasons why people did it, but I think there's a whole variety of things that you get out of an event like that, right? You're challenging yourself to do something that I imagine is probably quite physical, and in warm weather, you're challenging yourself to raise money.
Yes.
You're challenging yourself.
Emotionally as well.
Yeah, emotionally, and you're also making a contribution for something that, yeah, the people obviously cared about. I guess if you hit the right audience, it's probably not really difficult to convince people.
That's exactly right. And, you know, in our collateral, I still remember this line. It's like, we want to challenge your mind, body and soul. Mm. Like there's so many things that people get from physical challenges. People also want a nice holiday. People also want to to try and do something good for the soul. So we didn't, you know, we let people, especially when you talk to people, you start to realise why they want to do it. And you don't need to convince them. They're already interested. So you kind of work with them on why they're interested and sort of and allow them to sort of make their own decision. It doesn't have to be one reason or why people get involved. And I think back then as well, and this is something that I saw as a young person, charities seemed to be pushed on people. The young people didn't really enjoy charity because it's something that your parents made you do or your school pushed you into or whatever. It was never something that you wanted to do. And we wanted to make charity something that young people wanted to do as opposed to needed to do. And I think that in itself was a little bit of a psychological change in the way we branded ourselves and the way we didn't want to guilt people into caring. We know that this issue is hard already. We know that, you know, we have access to all the television and internet and stories that we can hear. We wanted people to enjoy themselves, to know that they're making a difference and know that their contribution, no matter how big or small, bike riding through Cambodia, making a donation, it means something and it does make a difference. But as long as you're doing something, you know what I mean? That was a really big, I guess, psychological shift in the way we marketed what we did.
Yeah, that's pretty inspirational. And I think what you talk about inspiring people to take action and to make a difference. So it's not just about, like you said, you know, a charity that perhaps you're forced into by peer pressure or school or parents or whatever.
That's right. And interestingly as well, when you looked at the landscape of charity, again, 10 years ago, it's different now. You know, black tie balls cost $500. What uni student is going to put $500 into a black tie ball ticket? Even $250. Our first parties were about $40 and you got a drink. And people knew that, you know, you had to pay cover charge to go into a club. So if you came to one of our events, you got a drink on arrival and you paid a cover. And look, you knew it was for a good cause as well. So there was a bit of that to it. And they'd have so much fun. And we might not have raised, you know, about hundreds of thousands of dollars from one event like maybe a black tie ball would, but we would engage a generation. We'd get young people thinking, wow, this is an alternative. I can go and have fun and meet like-minded people and I'm doing something for a good cause. Like, that's a bonus. That's such a tick, you know what I mean? That's a tick box. Mm. And they didn't feel guilty leaving an event. If they had a really fun time and they knew they were doing it for a great cause, again, there's no downside to that.
Mm. Now, I'm interested because you mentioned, you know, you emphasised that it's a very young audience that you were targeting and it was basically the millennial generation, I guess, to whom you were speaking and who you wanted to get involved. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you say somewhere is that, you know, you appeal to their desire to find purpose in things that they do. And we often hear today in the business world or so on that millennials are different and they're, you know, and this is all in inverted commas, and that they've got more choices and they're less loyal, I suppose, is one of the words used. And I often wonder if, you know, people are not, and I'm not a millennial, obviously, I'm sort of well past that, but I often wonder whether people are not missing the point here and that, you know, right throughout history, people have looked for purpose in their life. And today, whilst we've got technology and the internet, the way people behave might be slightly different because of the tools that they have at their disposal. But at the end of the day, it's really about finding purpose in what you do and how, you know, how that works. So I wonder whether you could comment on some of that, how it relates to business and also how it relates to your charity.
Yeah, totally. I definitely think that one of the interesting things, if you look at millennials, I mean, you have to look at the generation that and the society, I guess, they were brought up in. I mean, if I look at even just my parents' generation, back 10 years ago for me, my family worked really hard, like, you know, kind of post-war to really build for themselves and build for what they wanted for their own family. It was a very strict work ethic. I mean, I'm Chinese by background, so even, you know, that culture is even stricter in terms of what you want to do and the values that you have for your family and your education and all of that. Now, because they worked so hard, and even if I look at myself and my two older sisters and my younger brother, you know, we went through good schools, you know, I grew up in Australia, came from the Philippines. You know, my dad left from the Marcos regime over there in the 80s to bring up his kids in Australia. And you grow up with this sort of work ethic of working really hard and all of that. And luckily, you know, my parents paid for my school, obviously, my education, and that was fantastic. But then as you branch out into, I guess, the corporate world or after university, sorry, my I've got a bit of a sore throat, so I have to drink some water. When you branch out after school and university, you know, you realise the landscape is different. People, the workplace is much more flexible. There is more opportunity as well, and there was more opportunity 10 years ago even to what it is now for grads, I hear. And so I think if you look at that generational sort of shift in the attitude, I used to think that people, only older people got involved in charity or philanthropists. When you think of the word philanthropist, you don't think of a young person. You think of a person that's made it in their lives, like my dad maybe. He's retired early. He can sort of give to causes he loves, but he's made it. He's worked really hard and he hasn't really been charitable through that time, but he's made it. And now he can give back. Whereas young people, I guess, with the internet and with the kind of digital news we're consuming 24/7, you see so much in the world that needs your support. And as humans, we're emotional people. You know, I think we're people innately who want to give back. And young people are seeing this. They've grown up more educated than their parents in terms of schooling and opportunity. That's going to be a purpose and wanting to do something for good, as well as make money and all of that, is something that actually is attainable. You know what I mean? It's attainable for them. So why not go for it? And I think millennials do get a lot of flack. I remember we used to say this when we were in the media as 10 years ago, promoting Project Futures as this Gen Y-led organisation. We would use, you know, we know that you think that we're flaky and disloyal and all of that, but actually, if you look at what we love, even if you look at the fan base of Project Futures over the last 8 years, so much loyalty, the kinds of people that come on our cycles, like I know so many of them by name because they're just so, they're loyal to things they want to be loyal to. Mm. And that means that businesses need to change their tactic. And that's just part of being, you know, part of an agile and sort of changing workforce. And it's changing more now in the last 10 years than it had for the last probably 40 years of when my parents were in the workforce. You know what I mean? So,
yeah, I think you said something there that probably hits the nail on the head. I mean, for me, I think it's, you know, people across all generations are loyal to what they want to be loyal to. It's perhaps today there are much more options, much more alternatives given new technology and the state of the world. So that could be read as a lack of loyalty, but in a way, it's possibly just people experimenting with the different alternatives until they find something that they really do care about and what they want to be loyal to.
That's exactly right. And I also believe that millennials, I mean, don't get me wrong, when I talk millennials generally, there are so many different types of millennials. Like, so I'm not saying they're all amazing, that's for sure. But I do think that we do need to, as businesses and as people that give employment, we need to look at how they work and we need to understand that. We can't just try and fit a square peg into a round hole, particularly because millennials will make up, you know, something like 50% of the workforce in like, I don't know, 20 years or 30, 30 years' time. So we need to understand how they work, that there's so many good traits that millennials have, digitally savvy, you know, the most educated sort of generation. Yes, they're probably through technology that they're more distracted and they're more... maybe less consistent, but how can we build businesses that understand that and train them for that longevity? You know what I mean? And I think I think it's a good thing because then millennials and that kind of workforce pushes businesses to look at, you know, why do we focus so much on profit and growth and money and to the expense of, you know, taking people getting cut off their jobs and so forth. I mean, there was one NAB or something made $6 billion profit or something silly in the last financial year, but then they laid off 6,000 people. I'm not saying, like, and you just kind of look at those things and you go, is that ethical? Like, what does that mean? Where does that $6 billion go into the shareholder pockets, right? But what about these employees that have worked to make that happen?
Yeah.
I think that people start to see that and they start to question these things and they're trying internally as entrepreneurs in these businesses to try to set their values up so that they can work and earn money and have the things that they want to have. There's nothing wrong with that, but also do it in an ethical way or do it for a business that where their values are aligned.
Hmm. Yeah, well, obviously the values around money and corporate responsibility vary quite a bit between different companies. And I know even back in the 80s, there was a lot of push around being a good corporate citizen and contributing back to the community and also taking care of the employees. But at some point, I think, you know, there's the balance sometimes tips one way or the other when it comes down to what's the return, dollar return to the shareholders or whatever.
Exactly. And usually that always wins out. You know, excuse me. Yeah, usually that always wins out. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. You know, we live in a capitalist society. It works. But at the same time, you know, do we look at different measures of success? Do we look through, do we look at success through a different lens as we grow and as we see these values changing in that workforce? And it's possible. Anything's possible. I mean, we can make it happen if we want to. It just needs the will. It needs, you know, top-down leadership. It needs bottom-up, you know, people power. And I'm excited about the change that we're seeing. You know, something that I noticed, particularly when we started working with corporates and getting sponsorships maybe in sort of the third or fourth year of Project Futures, was CSR and corporate social responsibility was always a nice to have, nice to do. It wasn't really part of a business structure as a whole. So it would be very inconsistent. It would be very diluted. A lot of employees would have no idea what their company supports one week to another. And I think that's a shame. I think if, like any business strategy, everything that you do should be aligned, and good corporate social responsibility isn't just a marketing tool. There's a way that it can be, which I think is a good thing. I don't think that's a bad thing for companies to promote what they're doing for good and why, but they have to be authentic in it. And if it's not part of their underlying strategy as a whole, then it'll become very obvious very quickly how disingenuous that is. And that will affect your employees. It may affect your customers. So why not, you know, be quite crucial and consistent in the way you support what you support and why?
Yeah, that's a good point. So you mentioned about leadership top down and bottom up. So tell us a little bit about how you went about taking Project Futures from that first bike ride into an organisation, and essentially you became the CEO of that until I think the last year.
March this year.
Oh, it was March this year when you stepped away and kind of let it move on to the next phase, I think you talked about. So tell us a little bit about the leadership strategy in the early days, and then we'll talk about moving the Project Futures organisation into the next phase of its growth.
Yeah, well, for me, I've always been, you know, I've never seen myself as a leader. Like, I've always just seen myself as a person. And I think if I look back and I kind of can reflect back on the last sort of 8 to 10 years of growing Project Futures, I think the one characteristic that I possessed which helped to grow Project Futures was just like openness, honesty, like transparency almost. What you see was what you got. And that was just my style. It was potentially I was too open, but it was, you know, growing Project Futures from nothing to something. People needed to be on the same page. They needed a good communicator. They needed someone to share what the vision was, but then also like talk through problems and not just be the one to make decisions. We used to have, you know, these monthly meetings with what I'd call a management team, which was sort of 10 of my friends that sort of sat around a table. And sometimes you might think too many cooks spoil the broth, but we'd really talk out big issues and we'd really talk out what our next move was. And at the end of the day, knowing that you're the person that may drive it. And so you sort of potentially have the final say, but you can sort of hear and listen to the plethora of ways to go forward. I think that openness was really accepted and really, what's the word? It was really appreciated by our management team, which were all volunteers, but you need to be heard. And it wasn't sort of a dictatorial approach, dictatorship type approach, which some organisations can have, and that can work too. But you were also in a charity organisation. You're working off people's goodwill. You know, we didn't have any paid staff. So It was about making sure everyone felt that they were a part of it, making sure that they felt appreciated, making sure they had their say, but then being able to make a decision and go with that decision and everyone, you know, be on the same page with that. So I think my openness and my, I guess, honesty and that sort of transparent approach, I believe, is a big part of who I am and my style, if you like, which helped really grow Project Futures from the beginning. I also had a bit of a don't ask, don't get attitude. You know, I'd always look at everyone, you know, on the same level, whether they were CEOs or politicians or philanthropists. I would just have a genuine kind of approach to them. You know, I would just want to talk to them. I'd want to know what makes them tick. I'd want to have a conversation and understand them. And while I know I talk a lot, and everyone will tell you, like, I do talk till the cows come home, people might say I don't listen very much, but in order to get people, I don't know, I think you have to show that you are just as open in order for them to be to you as well.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's a couple of really clear messages I like there. And if I think of the context of a business where, like you say, sometimes it's a dictatorial style more than valuing people's input, if you like, whereas you took the approach that you're relying on people's goodwill, they're not being paid and they're not being forced to be there, so it's important to them that they have a contribution and that it's recognised.
Yes.
But I think, you know, one of the things that in business, one of the suggestions that people make, that a lot of business coaches make, is, you know, what are you really passionate about? What would you do if you didn't get paid for it? And so it's kind of the same thing, isn't it? If you could tap into what people are really passionate about and where they can make a difference, whether they're employees or whether they're volunteers, then I think you've progressed a long way into getting full buy-in.
That's right, yes. Mm. Buy-in is such a big thing as well. And in those early days, you know, we didn't have a big strategy. We didn't think 3 years ahead. We thought event after event after event. And people could see the result. And I think that was really important at the very beginning. We rode, you know, this wave of momentum. Each event got bigger. Each person saw the fruits of their labour, you know, after a certain amount of months or so forth, even when it got hard. It was fun. I mean, we always had such a fun style. We were friends, you know, we were like-minded. We had time and we used networking, social events, fun stuff to raise money for charity. I mean, how fun is that? Mm. And I think particularly for volunteers, they need to see the fruits of their labour, if you like. I mean, employees, sure, they need to be able to understand the long-term vision and be able to get there. But when you have someone on board that's a volunteer, and volunteers can be good and bad. We've had our fair share of really annoying ones, but we've had our fair share of great ones. But I think the key is to keep them motivated. There has to be tangible results. And with any organisation, big or small, you know, you have to pick and choose what to give the volunteers versus what to give, I guess, staff or employees that are really, really committed, you know, because volunteers can be quite fickle. But when they see the fruits of their labour, when they can feel that they are reaching a goal, that is such a huge, I don't know, it's so exciting for them, you know what I mean, to see that payoff and to see how much we raised and to, you know, come to an event where everything is just looking amazing and there's people in the room and everyone's happy. I mean, that is just such an amazing feeling.
Hmm. Yeah, there was another thing you said there that I thought is really good, the don't ask, don't get philosophy, which, you know, I don't know who it was that said, if you don't ask, the answer is always going to be no. So, and the other, like my philosophy around that is, what's the worst thing that could happen? Somebody could ignore you or they could say no.
And that's exactly
so
right.
If you kind of treat that as water off a duck's back, then you just keep asking.
That's exactly right. My other one, I had two in the early days. Don't ask, don't get was definitely one of them, but asking for forgiveness, not permission. Mm-hmm. So I would just do it. Like, you know, boards probably don't like that idea now. Like, you know, going off and doing it. But I was so adamant in those early days that I just wanted things to happen. And I didn't want bureaucracy. I didn't want like issues. We weren't doing anything crazy tough at that time. We were running really fun events, but it's like, let's just make it happen. Just go for it. Like, you know, if I make a mistake, I'll ask for forgiveness. And I think that any startup entrepreneur, any person that's, you know, really gung-ho about something, whatever it is they're passionate about, will have the same attitude naturally. They'll just want to make it happen. And
that's
they won't let things stand in their way.
Typically, it's the action takers that seem to have the most progress because they're out there first. And, you know, mistakes, you learn from your mistakes. So, you know, something didn't work. Why didn't it work? Okay, we're going to adjust that next time. And so it should be better next time. Whereas if you didn't try it out, you wouldn't have learned that lesson.
Exactly right. Mm. Exactly right. So, yeah, I think that sort of leadership style was based around, those mottos. But I think the openness is something that I'm most proud of because people, I feel like I got a lot of people's buy-in that way because I was so open myself. I wasn't, I was so willing to talk through our problems, to talk through what we needed, to share challenges, to share success. And I think that's something that allowed us to create kind of raving fans for Project Futures and people that 8 years later are still supporting us and still raising funds for us and still coming to our events. I think that's a really big thing. And being really authentically driven, like I think, you know, sometimes small things make such a difference. I still write handwritten notes and Christmas cards. I still, I make such an effort to really remember people and their names and who they are and what they've done. And that's just something more natural that comes to me and I'm really happy about that. I know sometimes it's hard to remember a load of people's names, but I think that's something that innately is a really good trait to have because these people don't have to support you. They don't have to give you money. They have to donate. They don't have to give their time. And remembering their name, remembering who they are and having genuine conversations with them to know who they are, I love that. Ask anyone. I can talk to some stranger for hours and be really interested in what they do. But that's me. But I do think that innate curiosity and that ability to give your time is something that many people don't have these days because everyone thinks they're too busy or whatever.
Mm. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, too busy doing the do and not enough time to actually live the life.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Definitely right.
All right. Now, so at what point did you stop your full-time work, implied work, and go full-time into Project Futures?
So it was, I believe it was 2013. So I worked 3 days a week for Project Futures and 2 days a week in my paid job to begin with for a year. Mm-hmm. I think that was about 2012 to 2013. And then 2013 to 2014, I built a strategy with a very amazing mentor that came into my life. And she helped me present it to the board and it allowed me to go full time. The board agreed to that strategy and I went full time for that first year and it was incredible. Mm. And then the second year we got a second full time employee and again, it was just incredible. And we sort of grew it from there. So it was about 2013, 2014, I believe, that I went full time.
Mm.
Sometimes all the years blur together. But it was probably, we started in 2009. So, yeah, pretty much for 3 to 4 years after that, I became a full-time paid employee.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then it's in March this year, you stepped down as CEO. Now, I take it that was a planned decision because you felt that it was time that the organisation grew beyond where you thought you could take it to.
Yes, that's right. I wrote a blog about it actually, which got quite widely circulated just because so many founders find it so hard to leave and I definitely found it tough. It was a really tough decision to make. You know, there were also disagreements between myself and our board, which was a good thing because I think it allowed conversation to happen because you're not always going to agree and that's okay. Mm. But I also think that I became very indecisive, I've got to be honest. In that last sort of year, maybe I was already thinking about moving on. I'd turned 30. I'd probably been thinking about leaving for about a year and a bit, but it's hard because you started something and you put your blood, sweat and tears into it and you always think that you're the right person for it. And I got some really good counsel from friends and mentors and I read an amazing book by Elizabeth Gilbert called Big Magic. And one of the chapters was It Ain't Your Baby. And I really loved that because so many people for so many years were saying, it's your baby step. Project Futures is your baby. And you do, every parent will tell you, I'm not a parent, but every parent will tell you, you have to let your baby go sometimes at a time, you know, usually when they're teenagers or when they're going to leave home. Or there's a time where you have to allow them to go off on their own two feet, right? And for me, I think my identity was so caught up in Project Futures as well, not because that was a planned strategy, but because that's just how it happened. And people were interested to hear the story of how it happened because it was so personal. And there was all so many different reasons, but I sort of decided, and it was a long decision to make, and the board supported me with it. So it was in about October last year I let them know that I was wanting to resign. And that's when we sort of made preparations together for a succession. My last day was March 3rd, 2017. The board did the recruitment for a new CEO. And there's just so much I learned from that process. It was very tough. You had to sort of let your ego down a little bit, or you had to sort of, you know, make sure that you staying on isn't just an ego-driven thing, because sometimes you have to be honest with yourself. It is. You're not the best person to lead it at this point. And a really good friend of mine said to me, he's the director of a very great private equity firm, actually, as for a young guy. He said, usually there are two people. The people that start up and scale an organisation are usually two different people. You've started it up. Are you going to be the person to scale? And he even said, I don't think you are. And so let it move on and find that person to allow it to do that, still get involved, still be part of it. But these are usually two very different people, particularly in the business world. It's sort of the same thing. And he'd obviously dealt with a lot of this in his career. And that was something that kind of hit me in the face. You think you can do everything, particularly when I was younger. I was like, no, I can do it. But sometimes you have to realise where your skill set lies and realise where they don't.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And I did read that blog post, and I thought that was pretty transparent in terms of, you know, the conflicting feelings that you've just described to us. It being your baby, but then the realization that perhaps somebody else is going to be better suited to growing it from here on in.
That's right. And I don't know. I think a lot of founders do think that they are the best person for the organisation, and it's very hard for a board or even advisors, you know, to let them know that they might not be. It wasn't until I potentially admitted it to myself and admitted it and asked other friends about it that they would then say, yeah, maybe you're not. Mm. But I'd have to have that realisation in myself first, because it is a sensitive topic and people don't want to tell you you can't do it. They don't want to dump on your parade. They don't want you to feel like they don't believe in you. But there is a point where you have to be honest with yourself, and I think for me, I needed to realize it in myself before someone else could tell me, or whether, because I probably wouldn't have listened to them either. And that's a big sort of slice of maybe humble pie you have to eat. But as soon as I maybe admitted it to myself and then went to ask my friends about it, and they were like, yeah, like, you know, it's not for us to say whether you are or aren't, but when you think about it, everything that you're saying and the frustrations that you have, maybe this time.
What were sort of the triggers that made you start to question that and come to that realisation?
I was definitely very indecisive. That's something that I never was back when I started Project Futures. I was asking a lot of advice from a lot of people and getting different answers and not being able to make my own decision, which was definitely a different to when I started. And so the indecision was killing me. Like, it was frustrating me, but I couldn't make a decision. We had grown in our staff. We had four full-time staff that I was managing managing staff is just a whole nother kettle of fish. I think I work well in a team, but managing a team is a different thing. So that was, again, new ground, I guess. I found that difficult. I found our team, while I and again, because I was quite open and transparent with our team knew about everything, we had meetings all the time, it doesn't mean that you're training them well. You know what I mean? So I was always there, but I think that style, you know, there is a certain style of management you need to learn that I hadn't really learnt yet. And it was the first time I really had managed a team. I'd worked in teams, but I'd actually at that point ever really managed a team before. So that was definitely difficult, and I felt it in myself and I felt it in the team as well. So there was that. I think I started to, one of the things that I would have to be really honest about is I wasn't as passionate as I was 8 years ago. I wasn't as gung-ho. That was quite obvious, probably. I didn't have the same stamina for it. I didn't have the same excitement about going to meetings and things. I was still doing it, but certainly the passion had dropped a little bit, and that's very normal. And I maybe just needed a change in that, but I did notice that as well. Those were probably the main areas that I noticed in myself that had changed, and other people noticed in me as well.
Well, it certainly takes a fair bit of self-awareness and, like you say, suppressing the ego or ego is a good thing in many ways, but not letting the ego control that decision, I guess, to put it in one way, to come to what you know is probably the right decision for the organisation and for you as well, personally. That's right. And I think a lot of businesses get to that point and founders get to that point, and the whole thing just falls over because they can't let go.
That's exactly right. Letting go is the hardest. And I probably could have let go a year before I actually did, but you have to go through your process, and the organisation didn't fail because of it. I think it actually just made me realise even more in that, you have to do it in the right time for you, but certainly founders have to realise that if you do it too late or if you don't really be honest with yourself, it could actually hurt your organisation and what's worse, you know what I mean? So that was a very big decision, but even looking back now, kind of 8 months later or however long it's been since March, I've got a great relationship with the new CEO. She's phenomenal. We actually met this morning for coffee. She reaches out when she needs to, and she knows that I'm always here to give her any advice she needs. She's doing so well, and I think she's great for the organisation. I still reach out to the staff, again, when they need me, but I've sort of left it open. I've left it up to them so I don't feel like I'm sort of stepping on their toes. You know, I've met with different board members when I need to. I was actually offered a place on the board straight away, and I actually said no. I wanted to just completely take the time off, and I get a place on the board at the end of this year or start of next year if I want it. And I spoke actually to the CEO of Project Futures today about it because she asked me what I was thinking. And, you know, it's funny, I haven't made a full decision yet, but there's a part of me that feels like I don't need to be on the board just because I'm the founder. Would I actually add value? And I don't want to be on the board for the sake of being on a board. I want to be able to add value. And there's still a part of me that feels like, you know, when you start something up and when you're raising money for something, it's tiring and you're asking. And I think part of a board member's role is to, if you're on the board of a fundraising organisation, you better fundraise. You know what I mean? You've got to put your hand in your pocket. You've got to get your contacts out there. And, you know, there's a part of me that still needs time before I really can do that. I know that there's also a governance level and there's also, you know, that responsibility. But I also don't think that that's really my strength. Maybe I need a bit of training before I do that. So I've accepted a board position actually at my old school who asked me to come on the board when I left Project Futures, and that's going to be an interesting learning curve, and I want to still maintain support for Project Futures, but I haven't yet spoken to the chair because it's not obviously the end of the year or the start of next year yet. But I think that that's an interesting thing to think about and think about critically, not just get a board seat because you're the founder. I don't think that that's the right reason.
Yeah, that's... Interesting perspective and full transparency there. So
yeah, that's right. That's exactly now, right.
When we publish this, it'll be after the new year. So
okay.
So you can have any conversations you need to have.
Oh, that's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. But we're open about it, and I think, and I do think that, you know, again, I'm still supportive. You know, regardless of whether in your, whether you're on a board or not, I'm still always going to be supportive of Project Futures.
And yeah, well, to use your children analogy that you gave earlier, it's always going to be your baby, right?
Yes, yeah, that's right. It's just in a different way.
That's right.
I'm not a tiger mum anymore.
Yeah, you don't need to have it attached to your apron strings.
No, that's exactly right.
All right, well, this has been really fascinating, Steph. I think it's time we moved on to the Buzz, which is our innovation round, and that's designed to help our audience, who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field, with some tips from your experience. So I've got 5 questions, and hopefully you'll have some really insightful answers for us based on your experience.
Awesome.
So what's the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Be curious. Interested and curious in the world around, you know, their cause or their business or whatever it is that they're doing. Be interested in the world around that and keep up to date.
Great advice. Yeah. And I think curiosity is a really important one for innovation. And unfortunately, a lot of people kind of let it slip a little bit.
Yes, that's right.
Because they're doing the do, yeah.
That's exactly right.
And what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
I think getting good people around you and brainstorming. We actually used to do brainstorming quite a lot. Something might have not come out of it, but you always have a fun laugh and we'd always get pizzas involved and pizzas and beers. You put a problem on the table and you just brainstorm. And I think that that is a really fun way to get people interested, to get people thinking, to get to know people as well, whether they're volunteers, you know, randoms or friends. I think that has always been a really big part of every sort of event we do or every new thing that we did, particularly at the beginning. We would have time. We didn't have budgets to deal with. We didn't have, you know, whatever we raised was great because we didn't have any paid staff. So to sit around a table, get people, good people around you and just brainstorm and think and put your ideas down, and it doesn't matter what comes out of it or what doesn't come out of it, but I guarantee you something interesting comes out of it.
Yeah, great advice. And it's a good way to get people involved, as you were saying earlier, get everybody involved and help them see how they could make a difference.
Correct, yes.
So do you have a favourite tool or system for brainstorming, let's say, or for coming up with more creative ideas?
We didn't really have a system. I mean, we really just got together. Like I really think that just bringing people together and putting conversations out there and starting to talk through problems or challenges or solutions or interesting news around different industries, I think that in itself is really, that was sort of our way. There was no, we had some facilitation on board strategy days or, we had team building days and things like that where we had sort of professional facilitators. But if you can't afford that or that's not part of it, I think making sure there's a driver though so that people aren't just talking aimlessly, to really pull it back to, hey, why are we here? Why are we here? Why are we here? And bringing that back. It is necessary. So we didn't really have a strategy or a way to do it. I think you just need to make sure that you've got a good driver and you've got a facilitator, I guess, amongst your group that can bring people back down and not just be a talk fest, actually get something concrete out of it. And whether you use it or not is up to you, but it's never a waste of time.
Yeah, that's great advice. So I think what I'm hearing there is focus, being focused on what it is you're trying to achieve and the why, and having somebody facilitate that if things go off track.
Correct.
So speaking of off track, what's the best way to keep a project on track?
What's the best way to keep a project on track? Good stuff. I think manageable goals, breaking down. I'm a list writer. Like I've got a, you know, scrap paper always in a next to me, and I'm a list person. So I'll jot things down. I'll make sure that I can cross things off and tick boxes. Even if it's as simple as mail this letter. Like, I'll just tick it to make sure I'm like, yes, you know, because sometimes you need to see, again, you need to see those ticks. You need to see those
progress,
letters.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a list writer for sure. I'm a bit old school. Like, I still have an old school diary that I write meetings in and stuff like that, just so you're aware and you're on track and you know. Breaking down big projects into manageable goals and having a timeline is it's as simple as that, you know, and you can do it however way suits you. Some people like Excel spreadsheets, some people like certain management systems or CRMs or something. For me, I'm like a list writer. It was funny when we got our first employee who was an event manager and she ran all of our events. She'd be like, so how did you do events before? Like, where's your management system for this? Like, what do you put your Excel spreadsheet? I was like, nope, it's all on my scrap paper list. And then I just chucked the list out and she's like, are you serious? And she couldn't believe it. I was like, but that's just how I work. And she worked differently and she had systems and she had a spreadsheet and she had timelines and all of that sort of stuff in her way. And that's great. We were kind of doing the same thing, but you got to kind of do it to your personality, I guess. And as you get bigger, you obviously need a better system so people can be across it. But, yeah, when it was just sort of me driving it, it'd be to-do list on paper. I know that sounds really crazy, but I guess when you have a knack for events or you have a knack for how things need to work, it just happens. And, yes, you do run sheets and you put things together so they're there. But, it was interesting. The management system you use has to be something that you will actually use. You know
that's,
what I mean?
Yeah, that's a really important point. I mean, there's no sense in having the best system in the world if it's not used, if you don't Correct. Use it or other people that need to get involved don't use it. Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm. All right, and number five is, what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Ooh, be authentic. Don't just go with the flow. Don't just do what everyone else is doing. Be authentic, even if it takes longer. Be consistent as well. I feel like consistency is probably something that people are lacking these days more than ever, I've got to be honest. It's something that, raising $5 million over 8 years, it doesn't happen overnight. Like getting the wins that you get happens because of a lot of hard work and time, and people need to give themselves that. And I think everyone is very used to instant gratification and getting things done now and seeing all these successes of all these other businesses and just seeing the top line, as opposed to really delving into how hard it was and you know, the obstacles that people overcame and the willpower that you need to keep going even when times are tough. And I think that, you know, being consistent and being authentic are differentiators that in this day and age will definitely set you apart.
Yeah, great advice. And a lot of my guests have kind of said variants of that. I love the emphasis on the consistency, because it does, I guess, it reinforces the authenticity. If there's a consistent message and a consistent kind of approach and the mission, everything's consistent with the mission and the vision.
Correct. Yep, that's exactly right.
All right, so you've mentioned a little bit about your thinking for the future. Where do you see the future for Project Futures?
That's an interesting question. I think that I see, that's interesting actually, because I obviously have been sort of away from it for the last 8 months. I mean, I would love to see Project Futures grow to support more projects. You know, we're a fundraiser. We partner long term with projects in the Asia Pacific region. In my time, we partnered with 5, over quite a few amount of years, you know, as we were able to grow and raise more money and get this issue of human trafficking known. I would like us to continue on that journey, because there are so many more projects that are in need of support. I'd love to see an end to human trafficking. I know that sounds like it's a pipe dream, but it's a man-made issue. Human trafficking is a man-made issue. It's not an unfortunate disease that you get where we don't have a cure.
That's right. Yeah.
Do it.
Yeah.
You know, it's about ethical business. It's about giving people livable, ethical, supportive and sustainable wages. It's about looking at it at a microeconomy or at a clothing factory that H&M own, and being able to look at their workers who produce that clothing and say, hey, how can we actually allowed them to have the opportunities that we potentially can have in their own context. It's a man-made problem. We're so greedy. Human trafficking happens because of greed. And sex trafficking happens because there's a demand for, you know, children as sex slaves. Like, it's appalling. How does that happen? It's a man-made issue, so it can be fixed by men or by women, men and women. I think that this is something that really can happen, but we need the will to make it happen. We need to change our value set. We need to change our mindset. We need to look at people as people and not commodities.
And I think there's a lot of awareness stuff there, because I imagine that there's hardly anyone that would argue with you that, you know, this is pretty appalling. That's stuff exactly that goes right on. But to then take the next step and say, okay, what can I do? And it may be contribute money to a fundraising initiative, but it may be other stuff. So,
yes,
I mean, that's right. Bioethically, in the area of clothing, I mean, it's correct. pretty easy there to stick with brands that, you know, at least as far as you know, treat their workers properly. Yeah,
correct. Or also, like, don't buy so much. Do we need that much?
Yeah.
Like, your own value set. Look at your own values and what makes you you, and ask yourself, do you need a $10 t-shirt every week? Where is that? Why is it $10? You know, who's fronting that cost? I guarantee you it's not the company, it's the workers. And if there's a $10 t-shirt on sale every single week, and you're buying a $10 t-shirt every single week, I guarantee you're not helping a poor person in a job making that $10 t-shirt. You're just indebting them even more. They don't have the opportunity to climb out of that. And people that say, oh, but we're giving these people jobs and we're giving these people opportunity. Well, there's no opportunity to save, because they can never make enough money to actually, you know, fend for themselves. They're just stuck in this cycle. Mm. And it's so harsh. And these companies make millions and billions of profit for their shareholders. And it's sad. You look at it and you kind of go, is that right? And I'm always the glass half full. So I'll always I'd rather work with companies and get them to understand than not. But I'm not about naming and shaming and doing all of that sort of stuff. But they, people need to work towards it. It will take time, absolutely. It's not an easy fix, but work towards it. Start somewhere. Mm-hmm. And you know, these leaders have the power to do that if they really want to. It's just a matter of whether they really want to.
Mm. All right. I guess I've got one more question kind of to finish up with in terms of advice. So what's the number one piece of advice you'd give to any business owner who wants to be a leader in innovation and productivity? And I think you've just given some of that ethical behaviour.
Oh, yeah, for businesses? Yeah.
What's the number one piece of advice you'd give to a business owner who wants to be a leader in innovation?
Ooh, interesting. I'd actually say look at your values and look at what you want to support from, whether it's a charity-based initiative or whatever, and allow that to be part of your overall business strategy. So if you grow as a business, like, how are you going to stick to and be consistent with what it is you value from a charitable point of view, from a giving point of view, from an ethical point of view? Be holistic with it. Don't chop and change. Don't give $5,000 to a charity this year and then $5,000 to a different charity next year and not really know what impact you've made, because these issues are long-term. They need consistency. They need long-term support. And you know, you wouldn't chop and change your lawyer every year. You wouldn't chop and change your accountant every year. You wouldn't like your staff to chop and change every year. So why would you want your charity to? I think that that's something so simple that every business can adopt. And as they get deeper and as they understand the challenges that each of these causes face, they realise it's multifaceted and there are, you know, root causes for the reasons of human trafficking, which might be poverty, women's equality, and discrimination or whatever. And they'll see that it's actually a vicious circle, but they're focused on an issue and they can do what they can for that issue and they can start to delve deeper into that issue and hopefully, you know, see results over time.
It's great advice. I liken that a little bit to being focused in business and narrowing down your focus to the things that are really critical, because people, whether it's in the markets that they pursue or in the, you know, the, where they spend their time, tend to be very broad, and the moment they focus narrower and narrower, the opposite of what they're afraid of happens, they actually get more and more success. So in terms of what you're saying here, I think it's analogous, because if you pick one particular charity or initiative that you're supporting, that's in really close alignment with the overall values and business strategy, and then stay focused on that, really relentless focus, you can probably achieve a hell of a lot more.
That's exactly right. 100% agree with you.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Steph. This has been really fantastic. So first of all, where can people reach out to you and say thank you for what you've shared with us today? And also, if you want to give us some things that the audience could do to support Project Futures, or you know, how they might find out other ways to get involved, give us that as well.
Definitely. People can get me on LinkedIn. I'm Stephanie Lorenzo on LinkedIn, and my details are on the Project Futures website, so you can send me an email if you like. But go to projectfutures.com and please get involved with Project Futures any way you can. There are some really great ways to get involved, particularly next year. We're bringing Somali Mom, who is the inspiration behind Project Futures, to Australia for a speaking tour. But definitely connect with Claire, the CEO there, and the staff at Project Futures, and or you can connect with me as well separately about anything that I've talked about. So thank you.
Right.
Check it. We have Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We have all the social media handles at Project Futures.
Okay. All right. We'll post links to that in the show notes, and that's pretty, sounds like some pretty exciting things happening.
Yes. Thank
all right.
you.
Finally then, who would you like me to interview on a future Innova Buzz podcast, and why?
Oh, there's a few great people. Annabelle Chauncey is a really amazing friend of mine who started an organisation called School for Life in Uganda. She was a law, she had a law degree and left it to pretty much set up a school, and she's built a huge primary school and medical facilities and so forth in Uganda. And she started again when she was around 21 and has done amazing work for the Ugandan community. And she is just incredible and has a sort of similar story, but obviously we've met a lot of differences. And she's an incredible young female who I think your audience would love to hear from. And I can send you her details for sure.
Okay, that'll be great. Thanks, Steph. So Annabelle, look out for an invitation from us to the Innova Buzz podcast, courtesy of Steph Lorenzo.
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks so much for sharing your time today and your insights with us, and talking about Project Futures and your learnings about the journey from, you know, founding the charity and starting it up to when you decided it was time to move on. So it was great that you were so generous and so open with us today. I've really enjoyed this and learnt a lot. And let's keep in touch.
Thank you. Thanks, Jürgen. Definitely keen to keep in touch. Thank you.
Well, I don't know about you, but I really enjoyed this chat with Steph. She really is a bundle of energy, and she gave us a lot of insights about building a charity from nothing to support a cause and what drives the so-called millennial generation, and about when a founder needs to step away from their organisation in order for both to continue to grow and thrive. Now, all the fantastic ideas and tips that Steph shared with us can be found at innovabiz.com.au/Stephanie Lorenzo. That's Stephanie with a PH, STEPHANIELORENZO. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.com.au/Stephanie Lorenzo. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Steph there, as well as links to the Project Futures website and to the other things that we spoke about. Steph suggested I interview Annabelle Chauncey, the founding director and CEO at the School for Life Foundation, on a future Innova Buzz podcast. So Annabelle, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the Innova Buzz podcast, courtesy of Stephanie Lorenzo. If you haven't already done so, please head on over to iTunes or Stitcher and subscribe to the Innova Buzz podcast so you won't miss any future episodes. We'd also love you to leave us a review, because feedback always helps us and lets us know how we're doing. And of course, reviews help us rank better and help other people find us. If there's anything you'd like us to cover, or questions you want answered on a future InnovaBuzz podcast, or guests that you'd like us to interview and have on the show, please send those ideas to us. We're always open to new ideas and input from our audience. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember to be awesome and keep innovating.